she was the great, like my grandmother before, but my mother particularly was the sort of Joycean voice of it all, you know, the stories. My mother had nature's supposed to abhor a vacuum. My mother had a horror of silence. I mean, if people, you know, around the table at a mealtime weren't talking, she used to think there was something wrong, you know, why aren't you talking? And it's a bad sort of... So she was the great talker. And then...
And then probably thought the angels were passing by.
Right. It's the beginning. I promise it won't.
You're fine.
Beginning. Coming home from visiting my mother, distressed that she no longer knows who I am, and cannot make any sounds that I recognise as words, I set down the odd fact that on this day, 45 years ago, 31st of May 1961, coming home from school under blue skies, I saw my first dead fellow human being. He was in the river under Victoria Bridge, where I caught my second boss, the 64 or the 66. I was 17. I've seen few dead since then, far fewer than the averagely unlucky 17-year-old in Gaza or Baghdad has already seen. I had a good look at him. Scores of people were leaning over the parapet and doing the same. I looked and looked. And when I got home, I wrote him up in my notebook, that drowned man. On the first bus, the 42 from Birchfields Road to Albert Square, I sometimes met a girl and we sat together if we could. Our meetings weren't arranged, but they weren't entirely accidental either. I worked out what buses were most likely on what days and went for those. But once, on a bus I had no hope about, nearly an hour later than our usual times, there she was. So really I never knew. We sat upstairs, if there was room, with the smokers. Often it was sunny, and the curls, the ringlets, the spiralling, floating, unravelling tresses of bluish smoke in the beams of sun made a pretty effect. I say often, but I don't suppose I saw her more than a dozen times. I never even knew her name. All I know is it began with M. She'd be there already if it was a lucky day, sitting upstairs in the sunny smoke and saving me a place next to her on the front seat if we were especially lucky. All we talked about was books, and I never touched her except in the way you are bound to if you sit next to somebody on a bus and you turn and forget yourself in conversation. I remember her eyes, the soul staring out of them, eager and scared. And I remember her lips and tongue, but not any single sentence that she said, only the tone, the rhythms, the feel of her speech, so close, the aura of her. She got off a couple of stops before me near Central Station, and of course I don't know where she went from there. A couple of days before I saw the man in the river, she gave me a present as she was getting off. She took it out of her satchel as she stood up, thrust it at my heart, and was gone. I never saw her again. I didn't open the girl's present until I was upstairs on the 64 on Victoria Bridge. The buses started from there, and you might have to wait a while before they were due to leave. All the years I was going to school, and for many before that, so I am told, there was a madman on Victoria Bridge called Charlie. He wore the cap and jacket of a sort of uniform, and he believed himself to be in charge of the comings and goings of the buses on Victoria Bridge. He had a pocket watch that he consulted frequently, and a notebook, and one of those pencils you have to keep licking to get it to write. The soldiers had them in the First World War. So Charlie, who might have been in his 60s at that time, stood all day and every day, rain or shine, on Victoria Bridge, waving the big green buses in and out, consulting his watch, shaking his head, and very frequently licking his bit of pencil. Everyone was nice to him. All the drivers and conductors acted along, pretending he was in charge, and even the real supervisor, who had a little office on the bridge, took it in good part. And you might see the pair of them, the real one and the mad one, in a slack time sharing tea from a thermos. But that day I didn't look at Charlie, though I normally did, looked and looked. I sat on the front seat from where you had a view, if you wanted it, of Telephone House on your right, Exchange Station and the Cathedral on your left, the dirty river under you, and I undid the girl's present, which she had wrapped very carefully and tied up with a red ribbon. I believe I was alone on the upper deck. I believe all behind me was empty space. It was a Wilfred Owen she had given me, and on a scrap of paper that looked torn out of a Woolworths notebook, she had written, "Here are his poems for you, with love from M." That was when I learnt her name began with M. First I looked to see how long the poet had lived. I had taken to doing that. I saw that if I were him, I'd be two-thirds of through my allotted time already. Then I opened his book, nowhere particular as I thought, and the space behind my back filled up with cold. It felt like a finger tracing my spine and inserting a tip of cold into the back of my head so that the hairs stood up there. I had ice around the heart, and I lost the sight of his lines in a rush of tears. Then Charlie consulted his pocket watch, waved us away, licked his blue copy pencil, and made a note in his notebook of the exact time of day that particular 64 left Victoria Bridge for Peel Green. The Irwell is the boundary between Manchester and Salford. The buses leaving Victoria Bridge cross it back into Manchester, bear left along it past the cathedral and the station, and turning sharp left, cross it again back into Salford and away. The man had been in the water for some time when I joined the others watching, and a couple of frogmen were in there with him, trying to push his head and shoulders through a life belt to haul him up. They had a hard task. He was so sodden and unhelpful. One took his head by the hair and tugged. The face was blue-grey. I realised that must be one of the colours of death. Nothing that colour could be alive, or not in any way friendly to human beings, at least. Though I didn't know I would never see M again, it was only a couple of days since she had given me the poems, and we often went that long or longer without meeting, I was already beginning to be anxious. I had to talk to her about Wilfred Owen. And while I was watching the men in the water under Victoria Bridge, I was wondering whether I should tell her about this event, and I would say it if I decided to. High above the river, just below street level, on a rather ramshackle platform affixed to the bridge, two policemen were watching their colleagues in the water and handling the ropes by which the drowned man was to be hauled up. I thought you might get to the platform through the supervisor's little office on the street side of the parapet. Had the river been a sweeter place, he and Charlie might have taken their tea out there on a balcony with a view. Friedrich Engels, working just round the corner in Chetham's library on the condition of the working class in England, thought the river and its dwelling places supremely noxious. Poor river. It had a coal mine at the very outset, and more demands and abuses through the cotton towns below. All its tributaries harmed it. But there were blessings nonetheless, reprieves and survivals, woods, for example, beyond the sewage farm at Clifton, and bluebells in season, hyacinthine streams and pools, like a surrogate living water. For the body of the Irwell was largely effluent. It needed what humans spilled into it to keep going at all. The rain itself came heavily laden, and before it reached the river must take on the further cargo of the gutters and the drains. The Irwell was never much of a waterway, and under the bridge and the sheer side of Telephone House there was little movement. Of his own accord, so to speak, the drowned man might have idled forever in the dead stillness under Victoria Bridge. The policemen took off their jackets and began to haul. In shirt sleeves on that dismal perch they looked like snowbirds. The drowned man, fitted through the life belt, rose in the water into a semblance of buoyancy. But very soon after that, when he was tiptoe on the surface, as though they were puppeteers and now they would get him to dance, the operation went wrong. The dead weight of him was too much for their arrangement of ropes. He slipped from the ring and was upended, noosed tightly around the ankles, the ring banging uselessly against his back. Water returned to the river from his jacket sleeves. We could smell it. There he hung, his clothes undoing around his midriff, hung and twirled very slowly, streaming. The frogmen assessed him. The police on the platform waited. It seemed his ropes would hold. It seemed they must risk it. At a signal, again they began to haul. Abattoir, martyrdom, circus, theatre, ascension. We were all very quiet. I decided I would tell the girl on the bus what I was seeing. I thought of the words. I felt certain she would understand what was happening to me while I watched. Suddenly there was a rush of things I must tell and ask the girl on the bus. Was her grandfather a soldier? Was his name in the book in the cathedral? And all the things my mother had begun to tell me about the Blitz, how she and her best friends in Telephone House had volunteered to carry on working during a raid, and the searchlights lit up the sky, and soon they could hear the guns and the bombs. And her and my father courting, Ringley Woods, the Bluebells, and how in the leap year, 1936, egged on by the other girls, while the supervisor's back was turned, she phoned him at his work in the post office from hers on the top floor of Telephone House and asked him to marry her. Things of that sort, so much, so many stories, all in a rush, by way of thanks for the poems of Wilfred Owen, tell her and ask her. The drowned man twirled very slowly upside down in the lovely light of day, the water still running off him, a precious silver. And slowly he rose, with pauses, with rests in the air, hanging down, his hands coming together like a diver's, everyone watching, all silent. It was perhaps the beginnings of my father's illness that made my mother, that spring and summer, begin to tell me stories about the two of them in their early lives. He was slipping into something that neither of them understood, and perhaps she wanted to assure herself of him by saying aloud how definite and luminous still their beginnings were. The remoteness of depression is hard to bear. Some acts of suicide in it may spring from the desire to be finally definite again. All the more definite around the depressive must the people who love him be. And perhaps that was an unconscious motive in my mother's stories to make me her ally in knowing some things for sure. The cheerfulness of the girls high up in Telephone House was one such thing. How she proposed to him in the leap year with some of them watching her face for the answer in it and some further off watching out for the supervisor. And under the air raid altogether, the lights and the noise, that was a brave thing to remember when it looked as though isolation by an illness might be coming up. But I liked best her assertion that on a clear day from the top floor of Telephone House, she could see Ringley Woods, where they went picking bluebells and came back on the bus with an armful, and she slept against his shoulder in the centre of them, lying in her lap like a child. And beyond Ringley on a clear day, you could see the moors, level and high. And once up there, as is well known, you can walk out together forever. That spring and early summer, now I come to think of it, there must have been something about me that was asking for stories. Because if it wasn't my mother telling them, it was her mother. And I stood or sat or strolled between the generations of women and listened to whatever they wanted to tell me about the girls at Ehrman and Engels Mill or Telephone House and courtships before the First War or the Second, long courtships, engagements, marriages. I watched my father anxiously, willing him with my mother not to go absent on us, and my grandfather, blown to bits, as his widow said whenever she reached that point, said with a shrug, him, my mother's father, I was beginning to put him together again, his life till then, till the blowing to bits, collecting him up, so to speak, from her bits of story and the documents, so to speak. There is no liveliness of words, comes anywhere near the life of life itself. At the last, the drowned man's feet caught under the platform and one policeman had to kneel, leaving the other taking all the weight. It was only then I noticed that he wore decent Oxford shoes. He turned my way, his tie hung over his open mouth. They meant no indecency, I'm sure, but in getting their burden over the railing of the rickety platform, they could not be gentle. They reached, heaved, landed him. He lay then over the railing, arms down, and between his arms, his head, the hair nearly plastered forward by the foul water in a V. He wore a suit. He was perhaps in his mid-40s. I could see him with a briefcase, conscientiously going to work and back. The policeman left him there, flopped, as though after a tremendous exertion, mortally exhausted. They exited through the supervisor's office and soon returned with a stretcher. Then it was finished, the spectacle. The crowd remembered their own business. I went for my bus, a 66, got the front right seat upstairs and craned up to see the very roof of Telephone House. There was a white cloud or two. The high buildings seemed to be sailing. The bus filled up, mostly young women from their work, nattering and laughing. On the bridge, the ambulance had taken the drowned man away. The policemen, still in their dazzling shirt sleeves, were having a cup of tea. Things were resuming, but not fast enough for Charlie. I doubt if he had watched the spectacle at all. He was in the road itself before the queue of buses, very agitated, tapping his watch and shaking his head. Suicide's one thing, but what about the buses? What about the timetable? His trouble was manifest and helpless. My pity, quickened by one thing and another, went out to him there on the public bridge in such an anxiety. He beckoned hard, stepped aside, we pulled away. I watched him lick his pencil and make the necessary note. Mustn't forget Charlie when I tell all this to the girl on the 42.